Good afternoon and welcome to Uplift Your Life with Dr. Paula. We're here every Friday at noon on the Illumia Radio Network to talk about your story, your life, and what we can do to change it, particularly the remedies and the cures, if you will, the ideas that Dr. Paula presents to help us look at our life and maybe rephrase it, rewrite it in a new way. How are you today, Dr. Paula?
I'm good, thank you. How about you, Kevin?
I'm doing okay. I have allergies now, apparently. I'm not sick, but I just have sinus stuff, as I'm finding a lot of people do. So I am here with you, all you allergy people. I have joined you finally at 49 years of age, and together we will make it through this. But besides that, everything is great.
Yes, Dallas does tend to have, I guess, a geographic situation that tends to promote allergies. And I found that with certain herbs that I get from my acupuncturist that I can really keep that in check and really don't have any problems since I've started doing that. So there is relief, and there is a way to treat ourselves and heal ourselves that doesn't necessarily or always require prescription drugs.
Yeah, and I'm one of those. I'm one of those people that will, like, not knowing that, will just carry on and, like, think that I have to suffer. But you turned me on to some good stuff, so I'm working on it.
Yeah, well, good, because I think, you know, the more we look into what we call alternative medicine, really the more we discover that it's been, that it was the main medicine that kept people healthy and alive in positive ways, that didn't do harm to their bodies. Yeah, long before we had prescription medications. And it's not that prescription medications are always bad. It's just that if there are other ways to treat myself that are natural, then that's and do the job without doing harm, then that's my preference. But, you know, everybody has to look into their body and their lifestyle and what works for them. I would never assume that somebody should do what I do. I just offer it as an opportunity for people to think about things in a different way, which is what we're about here, is changing our thoughts and creating new ways of thinking about things, because our society limits the way we think about things, and we grow up with certain thought patterns and told that this is good and this is bad, and don't look into this because, you know, that's not good for you, or that's all a sham, or, you know, they're just out to get you. And the only thing you can trust are the pharmaceutical companies. And, you know, we've seen enough at this point in time that we know that that isn't necessarily the case, and that, you know, everything is subject to corruption. Everything is subject to error, human error. And so it's really up to each of us, think, to take charge of our own healing, physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual, and make the choices that are best for us. And they may be different from everyone we know, but it and who's in our current circle of family and friends and the community that we've been living in, but it doesn't mean that it's not the right path for us.
Yeah.
And that's where we each have to find our own strength and wisdom and trust ourselves.
Yeah, you know, back in the day, I went to see this guy, a doctor, my friendly country doctor, and he recommended that I take some Valium, and what was the other one? Xanax. Oh, yeah, Xanax.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I would do just this is the craziest of all combinations, but it'd be a Sunday and I would take Xanax and watch football, which is just insane because football is just such a violent sport and Xanax just zones you out. And that's how I would spend my Sundays, plus a few other, well, you know, some beer and stuff. But I mean, like, you just, you know. And what happened is that you take it, like, especially Xanax.
I hope that's not a recommendation.
No.
Liquor with drugs.
No, I'm telling you, don't. Because Mondays would come and I felt horrible. Because I also didn't realize how much I'd been drinking and everything, right? So, you know, Xanax, football.
You were kind of zoned out, so you just kept drinking.
Oh, God. Yeah, exactly. And so, and then I would take it. In like both to Valium and to Xanax, you kind of build up a resistance to it and just doesn't do any good. All of those things are supposed to be like a temporary thing. They're not supposed to be like, I take it four times a day. You know, it's just supposed to be a temporary thing to where you get your problem fixed or whatever, and then you can move on or the anxiety passes. And what happens, well, with me, in my experience, and what seems to happen with other people, but with me, the anxiety didn't just magically go away in a few days. And then you're taking it, and then you need to take two or three or four. So anyway, fast forward to the future. I found out that I really had to do some deep digging and find out what the root cause of that anxiety was. And facing it and going through it is what stopped that. Now, I still have days when I'm like, I'll just be a little bit edgy. Or like about a year and a half ago, I stopped smoking cigarettes and I stopped doing a lot of stuff on this day. And just to get me through, I didn't take Valium, but I went to the vitamin store and I got Valerium. And I found out that there's a standardized version of Valerium, which I think just means it's a steady release. And it just calms me out. I have days when I have a lot of different thoughts going on. So I take this stuff called GABA, which just reduces the amount of neurotransmitters that are firing in my brain so I can focus just on a few thoughts, not on a thousand. And, you know, I still have my days when I just get a little bit edgy. But outside of just, you know, buying a valerian plant and planting it in my windowsill, you know, I try not to take a lot of medicine because pharmaceuticals were supposed to be good things for you, and they would take valerian and put it in a way, you know, that you could take it. But there's processes now, and they add in these other things to give it shelf life and stuff like that, that just aren't good for you and are toxic. So I try to stay pretty natural. And now I've got to the point through the meditation, when I stay on track and do it, really helps me a lot, and I need less of almost anything else, you know, so...
Well, I think you just wound up where in the best place possible. And I think when we can find ways in our day, natural ways in our day, to give our minds a rest and our bodies a rest through meditation, through a walk in nature, through just sitting, you know, allowing pleasant thoughts to come through, or watching a funny movie, or listening to beautiful music, you know, finding ways that where, as you say, maybe along the path you need things like Xanax, or currently I think the modern day Valerium is antidepressants.
Yeah.
But to just prescribe them or just take them without accompanying work to make sure, internal work,
yeah,
to make sure that you don't need them, that you can wean yourself of those things, then you just become where you're not yourself, where you're where you have to be drugged. I mean, we talk, you know, we look at sci-fi movies or horror movies, you know, the zombies and the, you know, people's bodies get taken over and all that. But what we don't realize is that really, you know, a lot of the medications that we give ourselves are functioning to create to allow us to function in a bad situation, in a bad life situation, whether it's a job or a marriage or a lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And so we literally drug ourselves, but we don't call them drugs. We call marijuana and cocaine and so on drugs. And I'm certainly not saying go for those. I don't want anyone to take that option.
Right.
Or alcohol, or even cigarettes, since, you know, all of those lead to physical, emotional, and mental harm. But we close ourselves down through drugs so that we can survive bad situations, as opposed to looking at what the situations are that we're living in and how they are not good for us and what we need to do to change them and to change the way we think, to change the story of our life so that we can create a healthy life that doesn't rely on medications to calm ourselves because we can't manage. You know, we have to keep our soul quiet because it's so agitated that it's causing us distress. And how do we really begin to listen to our soul so that we don't have to medicate it to silence?
Yeah, and that's the thing. I've had so many friends of mine back in the past, and I'm in touch with a lot of them again, which is really interesting because, you know, years ago it was like, let's all go to college together, and then it's like, let's all start a band together, and then it's all like, let's make a movie together, and then it's like, let's all get drunk and do drugs together. And now my friends are like, let's all be sober together because, you know, we're all now older and in relationships and, you know, we started actually doing the work instead of just trying to like pour medicine on it and hope it went away. And, we were all, well, I'll just talk about me. I was a walking drugstore. You know, I was like a chemistry set. You know, back in my day when you were a kid, one of the coolest Christmas presents you could ever get was a chemistry set. And, you know, it would, like, give you things you can mix stuff up. And it was stuff like making water blue and really harmless experiments and stuff like that. I was a literal walking chemistry set where I would need this to get me up and this to get me down. And when I was down, I needed to get back up, so I needed to do this. And when I was really up, I needed to do this. And it was constantly trying to manage my mood, which actually became constantly trying to manage the level of one drug against another. And it was all just to mask all the stuff that I was going through that I didn't want to deal with. I didn't know I needed to deal with. And I ended up just being numb and just not feeling things for a long, long time. But I thought that was the thing to do. I thought that was fun. All my friends were doing it. It's not their fault. I was just like, didn't know any better. And if there was any information out there that told me to do something different, it just didn't reach me. I ignored it. I just didn't, you know, that was my environment. And I thought that was the normal thing to do. And fortunately, you know, some of my friends went, you know, to the next plane of existence because of that. You know, I stayed here and found help and changed and everything. So I really get what you're saying with all of that and delving into the subconscious and changing it, because it was like I was on Xanax just watching the movie of my life play over and over and over again, and yet not really even watching the movie, not even knowing I was watching it, and I wasn't even like participating. I mean, there's so many analogies, but yeah, let's just say I'm better now.
Well, and good for you, and what an incredible role model to have woken up and to have allowed yourself to look deeply and to change. And that's something that we're all capable of, but not everybody is willing to do. And some people are willing to die rather than to do the work of looking inward and making the changes that they need to make. And, you know, this really leads into, we've touched on a few things here that I want to move into the discussion that I was thinking about, and this was kind of a precursor, a way into it, just through happenstance, but that always happens in our initial discussions, where there's a kernel there that really is the beginning point for the rest of our hour together.
Uh-huh.
And what happens in abusive relationships is that the person who's being abused becomes helpless and hopeless. There's a deep sadness. And when you're a child or even an adult who's stuck in this, you don't know what to do with these feelings. And so often we do zone out. Often we do go for activities or drugs or adrenaline-producing activities, racing cars or working in an ER room, an emergency room, going into high anxiety, stress situations because it's a replay of what we experience during those moments of abuse. And then the adrenaline kicks in and we feel alive.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas often the sadness just and the hopelessness, we almost feel dead inside because there's no way out. We're stuck. And when the adrenaline kicks in, it sort of reminds us that we're alive. And sometimes we even seek out abusive situations because it allows us back into that cycle, and at some point in that cycle, we feel alive. We can actually feel. And so the numbness goes away, or the hopelessness goes away, or that ever-present sadness. And I went the other day to see the ballet Cinderella.
Mm.
And I know this sounds like, what? Where is she going with this? Okay, so, sort of hang in there with me for a minute. I had always, you know, thought of Cinderella as just this wonderful fairy tale from, you know, these mean stepsisters and stepmother who are, you know, do mean things to this poor little girl or poor young woman. And then the Prince Charming comes along and saves her.
Right.
Well, suddenly I'm watching, knowing what I know now about abuse and the cycle of abuse and how we like to categorize the abusers as, oh, they have a bad temper, they're just mean, they're just controlling, they're not nice, you know, whatever, but we don't say abuse. And suddenly I'm watching what's going on, and this little light bulb goes off. Cinderella was the victim of abuse.
Yeah.
You know, her father was this ineffectual, sweet man who loved her dearly but could do nothing. He was also abused by the stepmother and stepsisters. So he's a totally ineffective father, incapable of protecting her. And she's in her own home, a slave to this mean step family.
Yeah.
But they're not just mean, they're abusive. And then she escapes into this fantasy world of Prince Charming and, you know, everything coming out beautifully. And, of course, it's a fairy tale, so everything turns out beautifully. But in most of our lives, unless we do some big-time changing, just having a fantasy that everything's going to be wonderful isn't sufficient. And if those of you who saw the movie Precious, the same kind of thing happened. There was the scenario when she was in the middle of an abusive episode from her mother. She would go into this fantasy world of song and dance and that everything was just wonderful. She was somewhere else or with somebody, some young man who loved her. And it was really, you know, the equivalent of Cinderella, only in the story of Cinderella, we never get back to reality because, again, it's a fairy tale. And so it has to have a happy ending. But in fact, that moving off to a fantasy realm where you leave your body because really you can't deal with the reality, the horror of the reality of what's going on. Mm. And Precious depicted in such a beautiful way. And I encourage you to think about, those of you who are listening, and maybe you too, Kevin, although somehow I think boys don't think about Cinderella as their, you know, favorite fantasy fairy tale. but Carolyn Mace talks about going back to your childhood and thinking about what was your favorite fairy tale, what was the one that you really resonated with?
Huh, yeah.
And we've talked a lot about how can you identify the signs of abuse, because emotional abuse is and psychological abuse are very different than physical abuse. And we don't necessarily know that emotional and psychological abuse are occurring to us, are happening to us, but we do know what physical abuse feels like and looks like. And so I just as an exercise for people listening to think back to what was the fairy tale that you resonated the most with, that you loved the most, that you wanted to hear over and over again, or if you grew up during the time of Walt Disney's cartoons and, you know, in the full-length movies of the cartoon or of the fairy tales done in cartoon characters. Now, what was the one that resonated with you? And think about whether there's a metaphor in there for abuse. What just came to my mind was Hansel and Gretel.
Oh, yeah. Very
interesting. You know, the parents who neglected you know, their children, and they got caught in, you know, the hands of this wicked witch who was going to eat them.
Yeah. Well, you know, now that you mention that, and you spoke about this one time on the other show, and I was like, fairy tales, I kind of remember Grimm's fairy tales and everything, but you know, as you're talking right now, you know what was my fairy tale when I was a kid was The Wizard of Oz. Because The Wizard of Oz would come on, they played it every year, like a couple of times during the year, because back when I was a kid, you know, they had movies in theaters, and if you missed it, you missed it. And then years later, they might show that movie on television, but that was it. And they kind of started showing classic movies on television. So The Wizard of Oz was like a huge movie. And I remember it came on every spring. And the reason is because I lived in Oklahoma, right in Tornado Alley. And there was a tornado that went down our street when I was a little kid. And we were always having these storm warnings about the tornado coming through and duck and cover and everything, right? But The Wizard of Oz, I would sit there and watch. And it was about this kid who had kind of like, you know, really crazy, you know, kind of abusive situation, or just felt really alone, and she would sing Somewhere Over the Rainbow, and I would cry. And then, you know, the storm would come, and you didn't know whether she was going to make it back, and this tornado would come, and all of a sudden, she's in this completely different world where she's trying to get through all these things. And at the end, you know, all her family comes around her and loves her and giving her and says, "Hey, Toto, and you were this and you were this," and they all really, you know, were really worried about her, and she wasn't neglected and all that. And I remember watching that. It always came on like Sunday night, on the Sunday night movie on ABC, and I'd watch it year after year after year. And I think part of that was definitely a fairy tale thing for me, and I related to it so much because she was a Midwestern kid in this family that was kind of here nor there, and she didn't really know what was going on. It just felt all alone. And that's my childhood with a couple of tornadoes thrown in. So, yeah, I totally relate to that.
Yeah, and she was in the eye of the storm.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then she had to find courage, her heart, strength. You know, she had to develop the qualities within herself to change her life, to change her story.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then when she came out of it, yes, in the fairy tale ending, she's back with the same family. But in fact, you know, the hero's journey would be to then find the family to face your demons, the Wicked Witch of the West, and so on, and to face your greatest fears and to find your greatest strengths within that, and the person who you need to be in order to change your circumstances.
Yeah. And I mean,
and to find the loving family and community. And we can create that if our original family wasn't that.
Yeah, and all the people, if I think about it correctly, really didn't change in her life. It was her perspective on everything that changed, right? When she found all of these inner qualities.
Yes. But also I think that the people in our life sometimes can be dangerous and neglectful, and people who who we've learned to see in the best way possible, but who, I guess this is where the metaphor breaks down for me, is that they really, the fact of the matter is that they really are not good, kind, wonderful people, loving, but we've painted them that way because we needed them to, we needed that illusion. We needed that ourselves to see them that way in order to survive, because we didn't know what to do if we saw the reality.
Very interesting. Yeah, absolutely. So I guess I did have fairy tales. And, you know, it's just, it's funny to think about it in that way, but different movies were my fairy tales and cartoons on television. And that's where I would leave to go into my kind of safe world where I was alone and I wouldn't be, you know, disturbed for a couple hours. That was my escape. Absolutely.
Right. And so, you know, the thing is that if we needed to do that as children, we had fewer options available to us, because often we were depending upon for sustenance, for shelter and food and physical care, the very people who were also harmful to us and hurtful to us. And so, you know, we don't have a lot of options. We have to find a way to survive when we're in those circumstances. But as we get older, when we get to be adults, then we have choices. And we can choose to stay in illusion, or we can choose to see the reality.
Yeah.
there's a, I think is a good place to bring this in now. It's a story that I wrote in January 2000, and it's called The Fog, and it's about this need to pretend and create illusion and escape in order to survive because we aren't willing to see the truth or able at the moment. So this may help some people because just like Cinderella and Precious and the Wizard of Oz and Hansel and Gretel and the Ugly Duckling, all of the various fairy tales and stories and movies that we currently see, I think story is also very powerful in helping to trigger feelings and emotions and awarenesses that we're not able to get to when we look at, when we try to look at our own lives. Mm-hmm. This is called The Fog. The fog flowed through the gunshot holes in the train window like a welcome escape. She didn't want to see what was going on. And here was her answer, as if nature responded to the silent call of her heart. Now she felt safe, even knowing it was an illusion. Still, the soft, moist cover felt like protection from the fierce elements inside the train. She had been engaged in such pleasant thoughts, thoroughly and delightfully oblivious to her surroundings, not to mention the impending chaos. Mm-hmm. She had only been peripherally aware that there were people around her, people busily engaged in their own pursuits, just like she was. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
That's okay. Someone's listening.
Yes.
They want to talk to you right now.
And then, okay. She had only been peripherally aware that there were people around her, people busily engaged in their own pursuits, just like she was, each of them drawing an invisible curtain around themselves, each wanting to create an illusion of privacy, each reading or knitting or watching the scenery. Only the parents with young children were wanting to connect with the other passengers. If they could only develop a social circle here, they might avoid the negative interactions that inevitably arose as the children became restless and demanding during a long journey. Not even the parents wanted this kind of distraction, though. This was not on their list of social activities for the journey between towns. She wasn't quite sure where they came from, who they were, what their motives were. Suddenly they were in her car, shooting holes in the windows. It was like they had lost their way and thought they were at the Penny Arcade. All that needed to be done was to drop them off at the small town fair they were just now passing. Maybe then all would be calm again. Now the conductor was finally inside their car. He was a calm man, yet quite worried. The boys didn't seem to realize that they were doing anything wrong. She watched in horror and disbelief as the conductor asked them to sit down, put the guns away, and behave themselves. So when the fog came rolling through the holes in the windows, she was very grateful to take shelter and pretend that nothing had happened. It was easier that way. Certainly there was no way to make sense of all or any of these events. Better to just go back inside her invisible curtain and pretend the world is safe, predictable, and sensible.
Wow, very cool. Yeah, interesting.
So I think, you know, that we get pulled off center and then we have a glimmer that something's wrong. Yeah. There's chaos, there are gunshots, there's... you know, things happening that shouldn't be happening, and then things calm down, everything gets quiet, and we go back into our pretense, into our cover of illusion, into our own little shelter that where we feel protected and safe, that everything's fine, it's all going to be good, nothing bad is going to happen in my world. And we want so desperately for everything to be okay that we pretend it is until the next time, and then we go back into the cycle of fear, of chaos, and then we shut down again. And this cycle keeps going. But I think the fog is a very powerful metaphor, because what it says really is that in order to live our lives, we have to numb out. We have to not live at our fullest. We have to pull the clouds over our eyes, and we have to not be able to fully be present in our lives and to live fully, because if we did, we'd have to admit the truth of our lives.
Yeah.
So I think that it's very important for all of us to look at what is going on within our lives, and where we're pulling the curtain over our eyes, pulling the clouds over our eyes, so that we don't have to see. Even just to ask ourselves, what is it that I don't want to see? And then to be willing to see and hear and become fully aware of the answer, and then to do something about it. Because if we want our lives to change, if we want anything to change, we have to be willing to admit the truth to ourselves and to move out of the fog and out of illusion.
Yeah, I remember one time there's a movie and Jeff Goldblum was in it, and I can't remember the name of it, but they were talking about things, and they were talking about relationships, and they said, you know, can you go through a day without, you know, eating, you know, like a hamburger or something? He's like, oh, I don't know. Can you go through a week without this? And he's like, hey, can you go through a day without having a rationalization? And everyone just got really, totally, totally quiet. You know, no one looked at each other. They just kept walking. And that always struck me and stayed with me, because how many times, instead of going deep, you know, to really find those things and take the time to delve into the subconscious, or just to really get alone and say, you know, who am I? What's my path? What am I doing here? We just rationalize our behavior. So, well, you know, I'll get better. Everything's okay. I'll do that again this time. It's fine, you know, da-da-da-da-da, because it's just so much easier. And it really makes you wonder. It makes me wonder sometimes, you know, what is real and what is illusion, you know? How much of that weird Matrix world, you know, another movie, how much of that weird Matrix world am I living in, you know? And how much do my thoughts really control me, and especially the thoughts that aren't really that healthy for me, versus what is really real? When I'm saying something, you know, when I'm listening to someone in a conversation, am I really listening to them, or am I just thinking about the next thing I'm going to say? When I'm, you know, trying to talk and speak, what am I saying? One of the things I talked to with my girlfriend about the other day is, like, we should just carry around a tape recorder with us all day long, and then at the end of the day, just play it back and listen, and just see if we really said what we wanted to say, and we were really being who we wanted to be. Because we say things to each other, and I'm like, man, I wish I would have recorded that, because that's just funny what you said. And we catch ourselves not really being authentic, but being something else. And we don't have to be something else, but we're not really saying what we're trying to say. And I think that's something that you're touching on. We just rationalize so much that it's okay, we'll get through it, or I've just got to do this right now, and then when I have time, I'll go back and we do this. And we're just so busy, we never get back to really finding out and uncovering what those things are deep down within us that need to be released and looked at, and we need to free that energy up from.
Well, absolutely. And we need to feel safe being who we are. I mean, we hide who we are because we don't feel safe. Mm. And, it goes back to that Marianne Williamson comment that, what we're afraid of is not our darkness. What we're afraid of is our light.
Yeah.
Are we willing to be who we really are and to show people the truth of who we are and ourselves, to show ourselves the truth of who we are? And it's bit by bit. It's step by step. It's not like, you can throw off all the masks at once, because that would do us in. We have to do it one step at a time and let one illusion go and then another and then another and one layer and then another layer and another layer. There's no way to possibly see everything all at once, like suddenly, all of the blinders get lifted, because our bodies and our psyches couldn't handle that dramatic a shift.
Mm-hmm.
But we can handle steps, and we can give ourselves credit for the steps that we take. And we can act on the information that we have. And to do things to begin to change our lives. Just one thing, taking a 5-minute walk, taking a 5-minute break in the day just for yourself. 10 minutes would even be better, but starting small so that it doesn't topple the system, and then bit by bit we can add to our time for ourselves, we can add to our new awarenesses, we can look at the gifts in what the negative things are or the things that we think are negative. Where's the learning? What is the positive that I got out of this? We can begin to ask questions and look at things differently. And I think another thing that I wanted to talk about here, at least to begin to think about, is what it means to be in community.
Mm.
If one, at least the last statistics that I heard, and they may be different today. If they're different, I'm sure they're larger as opposed to smaller. But 1/4 of the population is on antidepressants. One third of teenage girls are in abusive relationships.
Oh my gosh.
One third of women around the world are in abusive relationships. Mm. Now that's reported. Mm. And that usually doesn't include emotional and psychological abuse, because most people don't even know that they're in psychological or emotionally abusive relationships. And a lot of people don't even know that they're in physically abusive relationships. Often women will be interviewed after, something major happens, a major act of abuse, and they'll say, well, he was never physically abusive before, and as the counselor starts to probe, well, he did push me. Well, he did used to bump into me all the time, or step on me, or, we would bump into each other when I was going to the cabinet to get something. Well, you know, when you start to think about patterns, of course anybody can, every now and then there can be an accident where, you know, somebody where there's a physical encounter just because two people can't occupy the same space at the same time without there being a collision. But if it happens a lot, okay, and this is a pattern, but it's not a pattern in your daily life. You don't seem to be bumping into anyone else, or it doesn't seem that you're always in someone else's path or they in yours just as you turn or just as you go to get something. Then you have to start looking at what's happening here. Are these really accidents? Or is this person very conscious of where I am? And are they able to position themselves for it to look like an accident when in fact they've planned it?
Wow. Yeah.
And so, you know, what is happening? And if we observe these kinds of things, and this is where I want to get to community. Mm-hmm. We are all part of a community. The individuals make up the community. We're all part of numerous communities. Our gender, our religion, our race, our profession, our extracurricular activities, our neighborhood, our city, our state, our country, our volunteer activities, and our families are a community. So there are numerous communities that we belong to, and what kind of a member are we in those communities? Are we looking out for each other, or are we very busy pulling the fog, the clouds, the illusion over our eyes? Or even if we see something, do we decide it's none of our business? Mm-hmm. I was having dinner with some friends one night, actually people who I don't see anymore, partially because I was so horrified. But they were talking about their neighbor who on a regular basis they heard screaming for help.
Oh, my gosh.
Now, this is in an upper middle class family of professional adults. And this couple decided to not call the police, 911, ever because it wasn't their business. Mm. What do you mean it's not your business that another human being is being harmed and screaming for help? And even more so that it's by her husband. That's not an excuse that, you know, well, it's her husband or it's their business. No, it's not. It's all of our business. We are, a school is a community. The children who our children play with is part of our community. If you notice that a child is bullying or being abusive or cruel to your child or to another child, do you just ignore it, or do you just stop letting your child play with that child? Or you do you do something to help that child, to alert the school, to alert adults that this child's in trouble? Yeah. If a young child or any child is being abusive or bullying, they're learning that somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely.
And and so that child is in a way calling out for help. And what are we doing? Are we just pulling our child away and saying it's not our business? And, you know, I'm not saying don't protect your child. By all means, protect your child. But all the children, you know, that that concept, I think it's the name of a book. I think Hillary Clinton may have written, a book. But it was a belief system out there. It takes a village to raise a child.
Yeah.
Are we a village? Do we care?
Yeah.
You know, or do we just allow it? Do we just say it's not our business and hide behind some false concept that it's not us for us to get involved?
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so many times we just see things and we just keep driving right on by, or we're just too busy and everything. And, it's really tough.
Right, and sometimes we don't know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I encourage you to find out what to do. I remember one time I'm not saying that haven't ever not done my part. I mean, there are all of us who sometimes get caught, we get stuck, we don't know what to do. But then we can be prepared for the next time. So I remember one time seeing this woman abusing a dog, and I went over to her and I tried to stop her and I talked to her, and she was just so out of control. There was nothing that I was able to do.
Mm-hmm.
But now I know I could call 311, 311.
Yeah.
That's a number, to call if you find an animal in trouble.
Yeah.
There are resources that we have and we need to find out what those resources are and to know them. I met a woman from Vancouver who's a prosecutor, and her mission is for everyone in the world to know the signs of abuse, so that when they see someone who's in an abusive relationship, they will recognize the signs and they will know what to do, just like everybody knows the signs of flu.
Mm.
And she made that comparison. She said, everyone knows to sneeze into their elbow, into the crux of their elbow, right? Okay? Don't shake hands during flu season. Wash your hands carefully. How to protect ourselves and what the symptoms are so that you can act quickly. And her goal is for everybody, and God willing, she reaches her goal, that all of us know the signs of someone in trouble and act, because that person cannot act to help themselves. How many millions of children and adults are enslaved in our country and in the world? And it's not those other countries only, it's our country too.
Yeah.
And how many children, millions of children, are being sexually abused on a daily, ongoing basis by their families, or being sold on the streets, or both. It's horrific. And we go about our daily lives as if nothing were happening around us.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that we should live with a heavy cloud of horror surrounding us, but I'm saying do our part. Do what you can. Live your life the best you can live it. Remove abuse from your own life and do what you can to help the other people who are in pain.
Yeah, and I think once you begin to speak out and help and just begin to ask and do something, you find that you're not the only one. You're not the only one that was thinking, what can I do to help this situation? You weren't the only one that was thinking, is it just me that I just see this, or is it just me that has this problem? It's like, no, we're all connected. We all live in this world, and we all have this dimension with each other where, you're never really alone. We just tend to think that we are. And by stepping out and making a statement and saying, hey, you know, let me do something here. Let me call attention to this. I don't really know necessarily what to do, but I'm just going to at least just speak up. I'm just going to say something. In your community, you just find that you're not the only one that wanted, that was waiting for someone to stand up and say something. You know, it just takes one person just to make a start, and the whole thing can begin to change.
Exactly, because when you are in these horrific situations, the outside world often looks and thinks that, oh, that couldn't be in that family.
Yeah.
Okay, that, you know, he's president of this, or, you know, has a fancy title here, or makes this much money, and she, you know, dresses so nicely and always has a smile on her face. Well, you know that song, Put on a Happy Face?
Yeah.
You know, the world shouldn't know what's going on behind closed doors. It would shame me. You know, how could I face people if they knew the truth? Well, how can you face yourself, you know, if you don't tell the truth?
Yeah. Or I always think about, you know, smile when you're feeling sad. You know, the Charlie Chaplin song, which I used to love. And then I'm like, well, okay, I mean, it's important, you know, to try to be happy and everything. But just smiling just to cover up things when you really don't feel that way, it's only going to get you there for only so long.
Exactly. There, you know, there are some things that we can, overcome with a smile because they're minor, but there are deep-seated feelings of anger, of hurt, of despair, of sadness, of loneliness, of hopelessness, helplessness, fear, hurt, deep hurt. You know, putting on a happy smile is not going to eliminate those deep feelings. It's only facing them that, and in the facing of them and in the telling of the truth to ourselves, to a close friend, to somebody who we can reach out to and trust, to a clergy, to somebody who we can reach out to and trust that they're going to be there to help us and to support us. And if they let us down, then we have to go to somebody else. It's not like a one-shot deal. Oh, well, I tried. You know, it's we have to save our own lives. We have to save ourselves, and we have to save the people in our communities. We have to save the people whose lives ours intersect with. It is our responsibility. We are our brother's keeper, and we can act, often in an anonymous way. And sometimes in a way that's not anonymous, but being fully present. It depends on the situation, but we have to do our due diligence of finding out what to do, how to do it, and then to do it.
Yeah, that's a great way to sum up the hour that we just had. Thank you so much today for the show and all the things we covered, from herbs and pharmaceuticals to making a difference in your community and fairy tales along the way.
Yes. Well, thank you all for listening, and thank you, Kevin, and I wish everybody a wonderful week.
Yeah, we'll see you next Friday at noon with Dr. Paula with Uplift Your Life with Dr. Paula. Thank you so much.